When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Nature Made Me a Freak, Man Made Me a Weapon edition. It's March 16th, 2017. On today's show, Logan is the latest and presumably last installment in the Wolverine series. It stars Hugh Jackman as the taloned and brooding superhero mutant brought reluctantly out of retirement. Critics love it. And then the songwriter Stephen Merritt and his band The Magnetic Fields were 90s indie rock darlings. They've made a triumphant return with 50-song memoir. We will discuss it with Slate's music critic Carl Wilson. And finally, what is it to be privileged? Who has privilege and who has the privilege to call others out for being privileged? We discuss a provocative essay from the New Republic magazine. Joining me today is Isaac Chotiner, staff writer for Slate and soon to be host of his new podcast, I Have to Ask. Isaac, I am very excited to have you on the show and almost more excited to hear your new podcast. Welcome.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
And we're joined by Jamel Bowie, Slate's chief political correspondent. Jamel, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
It's a thrill to have both of you here. I have to admit, Dana and Julia, of course, sorely missed. They're both at South by Southwest representing. All right, before we dig in, Isaac, do we have some business?
We do. I want to tell you guys about a live show that the Slate Culture Gabfest is doing on Wednesday, April 19th in D.C. at the Hamilton. To get more information about this, go to slate.com/live. For Slate Plus folks, at the end of the show, we are going to give them a list of books they have to read before they die. That's a little morbid. Hopefully not all the books will be morbid. If you want to hear that segment, you can sign up for it at slate.com/culture plus. All right, Steve, that's business. What do you got?
Thanks, Isaac. Okay, diving in. It's been called less a superhero movie than a Requiem or Unforgiven with Claws. Logan stars Hugh Jackman as the X-Men alumnus Wolverine. It's the series' final installment, presumably. Never say never in that business. It's a brooding movie directed by the very gifted James Mangold, he of the movies Heavy and Copland. Mangold does his best to place recognizably human emotions at the center of a story of men and women with superpowers. In Logan, the Wolverine now lives in Texas, near the Mexican border, driving a limo for hire, caretaking Caliban, the albino mutant, and Charles Xavier, whose epileptic-like fits shudder the earth. Into their dreary, airless, and generally senescent world comes a young girl with mutant ex-childlike superpowers, and adventuresome mayhem ensues. Let's listen to a clip.
Who's this?
Just a guy telling you to get back in your nice truck. Go play Okie Dickhead somewhere else.
Hey, Carl. It looks like Mr. Munson hired some muscle.
Looks that way.
He's a friend of mine.
Friend with a big mouth.
I hear that a lot.
And you probably hear this, too.
More than I'd like.
and you know the drill. I'm gonna count three, and you're gonna start walking away.
I got rights to this one.
One.
I have a lawyer now.
Two.
Three.
You all right, boss?
You know the drill. Get the hell out of here.
All right, well, Jamel, let me start with you. This isn't the first sort of mopey, serious superhero movie. The problem with that mode often is that it kind of crosses the line between serious and self-serious. People think Logan really pulls this off. Did you?
I think it did, and I think it avoided that self-seriousness by not – I mean, the movie is obviously about larger themes. It deals a lot with grief and regret and violence and questions of what it means to be a violent person. And, you know, what it reminds me in a lot of ways of Unforgiven in its general tone and mood. But it's very much grounded in these characters. And what's a bit funny about it is that it takes the fact that there is this 15-year convoluted continuity of X-Men movies and strips it all away to the two most prominent characters in that series, Wolverine and Professor X, and gives us the story that's really centered on their relationship and their history. And I think the thing I've told people who want or are interested in seeing the movie but have not watched the X-Men movies is that if you know anything about those two characters, you should be able to enjoy the movie without really having any background, which I think is a real strength of the film. And in sort of its seriousness and maturity is a welcome change from, say, last year's Batman versus Superman, which was just kind of turgid and bad and, as you said, self-serious.
When this movie was being billed a couple months ago, it was sort of as a serious superhero movie. And I think when most people hear that, you think some version of Christopher Nolan. And self-serious, I think, is a good term for Christopher Nolan stuff, but just sort of self-important, too, that there would be a lot of moralizing. This movie is, I think, a little bit too long the way Christopher Nolan movies tend to be, but it does not sort of have that overwhelming, overbearing self-importance. There are not as many conversations as you find in a Christopher Nolan movie about good and evil and what it all means. And everything just seemed a little lighter. I think Jamel's really right to reference a Western because it did feel more like a sort of stripped down, spare Western.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, late in the day, you know, kind of the mythology is starting to wear off and saturated with grief and regret. Jamel, I have to say I brought absolutely no background to this movie. I hadn't seen an X-Men movie, was not a huge fan of the comic book when I was a kid. It worked for me completely as a film. It's beautifully made. Jackman is mesmerizing, heavy-spirited, but mesmerizing. Patrick Stewart is terrific. Stephen Merchant, I was a complete surprise to me. I had no idea he was going to appear in the movie. He's terrific in it. I have to say, though, it is, for being so saturated in grief and regret, I wasn't quite sure what they were grieving or regretful of. Was that clear to someone who knew the deep mythology in the universe?
Yeah, I think this is it's funny because the film does totally work with no background whatsoever. But for those of us who have been watching the film series since, you know, 2001, if this is when the first X-Men movie came out, or familiar with the comics, kind of the Wolverine story, Logan's story, is in part about someone who is, you know, bred and built to be a weapon, but hates killing, does not like the fact that he is proficient at killing, and it weighs on him and it burdens him. And I think that is what, you know, Logan is struggling with in the film. The movie makes reference to the fact that the X-Men are dead, that they all die one way or another. And so added to this, to both Logan's struggling with the fact of his lifetime of killing and the fact that his friends are dead, is this other fact that Logan can't really die, or at least it will take him a very long time to die a natural death. His healing factor, which is sort of his chief mutant power, also keeps him alive. And if you watched the previous two Wolverine movies, including the first one, X-Men Origins, which is quite bad and no one should watch it, and so I highly recommend that you don't. But if you watch that one, and if you watch James Mangold's first entry in this series, The Wolverine, you know that he's been alive since basically the late 19th century. So at this point in his life, he's almost 150 years old, and everyone he's loved is dead or dying. And that's what he carries around with him. And that's part of what explains his deep reluctance to get involved with this little girl, who I think we should talk about because I thought her performance was fantastic.
Yeah, you know, agreed. She's at the heart of the movie. Absolutely. This the one conceit of the movie that gives nothing away for listeners of ours who haven't seen it is that a new generation of super weaponized mutant ex-children are being bred, and one of them has escaped. Jamel, talk about the girl's performance at the center of the movie.
Sure. So the movie is called Logan, but I'd say the film is very much about as well this little girl named Laura, who is one of these mutant children. She's played by a young actress named Daphne Keene. And what I saw the movie twice, actually. I saw it the opening weekend, then I visited some friends and they wanted to check it out as well. So I, not intending to, ended up just watching it twice. And the second time I really paid attention to her. And what I think is so great about her performance, that for the first half of the movie, she's basically silent. She, other than sort of the grunts she makes while in combat, and a parenthetical here, the thing that convinces Logan to at least give her a ride, and much of the movie is taking place in cars and on highways, is that she has a healing factor like him and has adamantium laced skeleton and claws like he does. So she's sort of a mini Wolverine, in the body of this 11-year-old. But she, other than her grunts and yelling while killing people, she is silent. And despite her silence, or, you know, because of her silence, I'd say, she communicates so much emotion and so much curiosity and fear and pain as this sort of almost feral child for the first half of the flick. And I thought it was just terrific, more so the second time when I was actually paying more attention to her.
Yeah.
Jamel, do you think that it seems like this would be a perfect ending to kind of the Logan story, to the story of this character, Wolverine? But it also seems as if the studio is not going to be able to rest on their laurels with this because it's making a huge amount of money and is extremely popular with critics and audiences. So I was just wondering, I mean, where do you think this story is going to go? Because I just cannot believe this is going to be the end of it.
Yeah, that's interesting because there are a couple of things happening. The first is that a couple of years back, right, Fox rebooted the whole series with X-Men Days of Future Past, which basically like erased the first three movies from the series continuity. But the latest X-Men movie proper, X-Men Apocalypse or whatever it was called, was not very good and was widely panned and sort of a mess. And it's not clear whether Fox will continue forward with that particular iteration of the franchise. And what it's sort of, that's happening. Simultaneously, what's happening sort of in Marvel's official Marvel Studios, not the Marvel Fox collaboration, is that Marvel Studios is very clearly like prepping new generations of heroes for whenever these original actors decide to hang it up. And you see this in the comics too. So right now in the comics, Iron Man is a black woman, Captain America was a black guy for a while, the Hulk is an Asian American. I mean, sort of you can see them getting ready for this next generation. And so there's sort of like a template here in Daphne Keene's character as this like little mini Wolverine and some of the other characters in the movie for kind of if they wanted to do a next generation X-Men movie, all the pieces are there. And I don't know what the plan is, but I could see it happening. I do know that there is the series is called New Mutants, a movie in pre-production. The New Mutants were a spinoff from the X-Men in the 80s and were kind of like, you know, by this point in the continuity, the original X-Men had gone their separate ways and Xavier was pulling together a new generation of mutants to be X-Men. So given that no one knows about the New Mutants as a comic book property other than nerds, there's like space there to, build a new franchise out of out of the pieces from Logan.
This raises an interesting question to me, which is as a non-fan of the franchise, which is, you know, or really comic book movies in general, the I think interesting and at least somewhat daring choice to bring in directors who might be ambivalent about the material because they made their name either in indie movies or somewhat elevated adult, you know, movies aimed at adults. Someone like Mangold, and as someone who's very fresh to this material, I felt as though I kept picking up Mangold's ambivalence, but smart and interesting ambivalence, that in one of the ways Isaac the movie maybe was saturated with grief and regret was this sense that, you know, Mangold was forced to make a hyper-violent genre picture as someone who maybe didn't love the style of hyper-violence that he was working in. There's the interesting moment where they're watching Shane on a hotel television, and it's an especially downbeat moment where they seem to be captivated by what's happening on the screen, a golden era Hollywood movie in which good and evil are relatively starkly, you know, opposed against one another. Am I right to think that there might have been some ambivalence on the part of someone like Mangold in making a movie like this, and that's why its tone feels so earned?
I mean, that's an interesting theory. I think that could be true. I mean, Mangold has also made, I mean, he's made some good movies. I thought Copland was pretty good. He also made a terrible Tom Cruise, Cameron Diaz action movie called Night and Day, I think. Anyway, I do think what you're, the phenomenon you're talking about, and Jamel probably has this recall easier at hand than I do, but I remember the guy who directed The Amazing Spider-Man, which was the sort of first reboot. We're getting a second reboot of the Spider-Man origin story, I think, this year. But the guy who directed The Amazing Spider-Man 1 and 2, 5 and 3 years ago, was this guy, Mark Webb, who'd made this movie 500 Days of Summer, which was kind of this well-liked independent film. And it was thought, oh, we're going to bring a different sensibility. And then if you watch either of those Spider-Man movies, they're a giant mess. He doesn't know how to direct action. They're completely confused in what they are. So I agree it can work if you bring a different sensibility. But I also think it's a risk. And it seems to have paid off here. But I do wonder about that. Rather than bringing in kind of pros who know how to direct action and know the beats of the genre, on the whole, whether it works. I mean, I think most people would say Christopher Nolan, who I mentioned before, was the sort of the most famous choice in terms of doing that. And, you know, at least in my mind, he made 1.5 good Batman movies or something. But and then it sort of went off the rails. But, you know, I do think that's a hit and miss proposition.
One quick question before we move on. Logan does not like guns, as he says at one point in the movie, but he's forced to, gore people eye to eye in this hyper-violent and quite intimate fashion, which is really central to the look and style and, you know, kind of theme of the movie. Violence is hand to hand and very bloody. He essentially pops out these huge metal talons and shoves them into the, you know, soft midsection of his foe. Did anyone else find this movie more violent? Not just violent, they all are violent, but more violent and more self-consciously violent than other movies in the genre?
I actually interpreted this as, when I saw the marketing and when I noticed the violence, as somewhat of a nod to Deadpool. I don't know. I assume the plan for this movie was always to make it somewhat grittier and more violent than most PG-13 superhero movies are. But I also assume after Deadpool, which came out last year and was rated R and is very violent and made a boatload of money and was extremely popular, that studios are feeling like they can push the violence harder with R-rated movies.
Yeah, interesting. All right, well, the movie's Logan. It's at a theater very near you. No doubt, check it out. It's quite well made. All right, moving on. In 1999, the indie rock band The Magnetic Fields came out with what really has to count as an opus. The 69 Love Songs was a triple CD. It was filled with every conceivable song style, from Fleetwood Mac imitation to High School Football cheer. Across all pop formats, it was widely received as a masterpiece, and then followed, what exactly, a nice enough career in indie pop songcraft and indie stardom. But I think it's fair to say that Stephen Merritt, the principal songwriter of the Magnetic Fields, had placed himself under his own shadow. Nearly 20 years later comes 50-song memoir, and Stephen Merritt has stepped out of his own shadow. And as Carl Wilson, Slate's music critic, argues in a wonderful review, he stepped out in his own skin. Carl, how's it going?
Hey, Steve. Yeah, The title 50-song memoir, like the title 69 Love Songs, is is supremely literal. And so Meredith's just turned 50 in the past couple of years, and he's written one song for each year of his life.
Well, let's get to the arc of that story in a minute. But first, can you pick out a song for us to sample, give our listeners some sense of what this music sounds like?
It's difficult because it crosses so many styles and genres in Merritt's way. But I think I might pick from the second disc, the 1974 song, No, which gives you a little hint about his childhood environs a bit, and also his pushback against those.
We knew Camus, the faith healer, the black Christ, he said, laying his hands on high and low. Did he cure colds and cancer and bring back the dead? Did he refuse donations? No.
It's just so perfectly Stephen Merritt. The punchline of No is just beautifully delivered. Carl, let's start here. I mean, I was a huge fan of the 69 love songs when it came out. It struck me, and I think many people, as a harbinger of great things to come. And then in a way, it stood sort of alone as this peak in the guy's career. What is it about this format that seems to liberate him, to give it him, you know, sort of writing a kind of gimmick by which you can write not just 10 songs or 20, but a few dozen? What is it about that that you think that maybe gives him momentum and cogency as a songwriter?
Yeah, it's kind of a unique factor. I can't think of another songwriter of whom you can say that they work best in the like 2.5 hour anthology form. And I think it's partly that all of the albums since 69 Love Songs, you know, the albums before that were really kind of youthful, exploratory things. They also worked conceptually, but there was definitely sort of a more dreamy kind of aspect to them. And then things seemed to come into a sharper focus with 69 Love Songs. And the albums since then kind of returning to smaller scale concepts, either musical concepts or thematic concepts, all seemed in kind of inevitably thin by comparison. There were always a few great songs on every album, but a lot of the working out of the conceits started to seem a little bit like working in novelty song. And there were a lot of things that seemed kind of throwaway. And now returning to this kind of large canvas and with a theme that has some heft of its own, you know, that had the idea of life overall, just like the idea of love overall, seems to balance Merritt's tendency to go a little bit too micro and twee and clever. And so you get this kind of force. And on top of that, I think this album, even more so than 69 Love Songs, brings the power of narrative to bear. You know, you actually follow a story over the course of this 2.5 hours, this sort of Gen X chronological memoir, and in some ways also a sort of queer life in the late 20th century memoir that gives it a momentum. You know, I think a lot of people tend to feel that the last disc and a half or so of 69 Love Songs, your attention starts to drift a little bit, but that doesn't really happen here because you're kind of watching a movie. You're kind of going like, how's our hero going to fare? Is he going to be okay? Is he going to be happy in the end?
There's layers of hidden angst and feeling in a way, right? I mean, there's a play between what he keeps buried and what he brings to the surface that his voice and his writing style both seem suited to. Talk a little bit about the role confession has or hasn't played in his career thus far and how that maybe has changed here.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the dramatic thing about this work in the line of his work. In many ways, Merritt has always kind of forcefully rejected the idea of confession. And I think that comes from a couple of sources. On one level, it's having grown up with this kind of hippie childhood and at the time of the burgeoning of confessional song in the 70s, a lot of songwriters of his sort of 90s indie vintage backed as far away from that as possible. And on top of that, you have the way that queer art has always privileged artificiality and constructs of character against the idea of some kind of transparent sincerity, I think both as an aesthetic and as a kind of survival strategy. And so you really have Merritt turning against his own history here. And in an interesting way, treating autobiography as its own kind of artificial construct. So he plays with that throughout the album. And it's also, you know, Merritt is kind of a famously not particularly social and kind of dour and cranky seeming personality. And so this kind of like bearing your heart kind of thing is also counterintuitive in terms of his kind of presented character. So he's really challenging himself in some ways. And also there's something particularly poignant about someone in middle age kind of taking the mask off, however tentatively. And I think in a lot of ways, what you feel over the course of the album is this sense of this personality, this complex personality, coming to terms with himself and trying to sort of, in middle age, contact the sort of more tender and vulnerable part of himself. And in that, that's one of the things that makes it such a compelling listen.
I was just curious to what degree this album is sort of self-consciously a response to some of the sort of feelings of criticism or being let down by the latest work before this.
It's difficult to tell. Again, Merritt in interviews is not particularly forthcoming about these things. There are a couple of sharp jabs at critics over the course of the album. At one point, sarcastically remarking about critics who think he's too heavily New Wave influenced. And in one song, Quotes, which is probably like the most opaque song on the album to a non-initiate, he talks at angles about a controversy about 10 years ago when he got accused of racism by some critics for a stray remark he once made at a conference about the song Zippity-Doo-Dah, and also for the sort of whiteness of the influences that he works with, all of which sort of seemed unfair on a bunch of levels, and he kind of comes back at this with this kind of complaint about the media here. So there's a sense that there's some awareness of that. But interestingly, like, this album wasn't even, by his account, his own idea. The head of his record company looking for, I think, a way to come back to the 69 Love Songs attention suggested autobiography as a theme, and Merritt embraced it. So, yeah, it's hard to tell exactly what kind of web of motivations are working into it.
All right. Well, why don't we pick a track to go out on? What do you think? Have you seen it in the snow?
Yeah, that song definitely, which is his 9/11 song, an ode to New York, that really is just a gorgeous and elegant piece.
But have you seen it in the snow?
You're here. All right. Well, Carl, as always, it's a total pleasure to have you on the show. Hope to see you soon. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much, Steve.
When it snows all night and the world glows white in the morning light, oh, have you seen it in the snow?
In a new essay in the New Republic by Phoebe Maltz-Bovey, the author wonders if the accusation of privilege hasn't gone too far, partially as a ritual of public shaming in the age of the internet, partially as a generational fact. She asks whether it has brought about a more just society. Decades of privilege checking corresponds, after all, with decades of rocketing income inequality. Isaac, I have written before me a proposition in my notes that says everyone is more privileged than someone else. And at all times, we're making privilege hierarchies in our heads. I agree with one fundamental premise of the essay, that privilege is a fairly universal and insinuating concept. What did you think?
I thought it was an interesting essay. I thought she made a couple a couple smart points. The first of which is that essentially transparency about these things does not heal the problem. The idea that if we are more aware of everyone's privilege and we're aware of where we supposedly rank on these hierarchies, that in itself does not heal society's problems. That the work to take the work it takes to do that is much harder and more challenging. And I think that's a nice corrective to this idea that putting these things in the open will, by definition, help solve them. So that was my main takeaway from the essay.
One of the ways in which I thought she was troubling the notion of privilege is that everyone is conceivably more privileged relative to someone else.
Yeah.
And vice versa, right? There's no such thing as a rigid privilege hierarchy that's perfectly perspicuous and perfectly linear that one can place oneself in. So it tends to be a psychological or rhetorical strategy more than, you know, say an empirical fact of the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this is a complicated issue whenever we're talking about anything related to this. I remember once many years ago reading an essay in the Atlantic Monthly, and it was a discussion of how children under divorce psychologically deal with it. And the reviewer of the book said something like, well, why are we worried about kids whose parents have gotten divorced when other kids have been abused or molested? And I always thought that was not a good way to go about looking at the world, to say, well, someone else's problems are, you know, worse than yours, because, you know, we could be in Nanking in, you know, 1930s or something, and things would be even worse than they are in America today, whatever the subject is. But I also think that there is something to be said that there are degrees of privilege that everyone has, and we should be aware of them. So, I mean, it's finding a line about these things. There are problems that are worse than other people's problems, and there are degrees of, you know, gifts that people were given by, you know, their parents or whatever it is, and those things are different in society, and we do need to be aware of them. So it is finding a line between those two things.
Jamal, what did you make of this?
I both basically think the essay is on target, but I don't think it goes far enough in its critique of privileged discourse. Privileged discourse doesn't do much about solving existing inequalities. It becomes somewhat solipsistic, with everyone has privilege and everyone accusing each other of privilege, and it's very focused on the individual. I think that is all right. And it gets to sort of the problem with privileged discourse, but I'm not sure that this essay really quite diagnoses. Because the problem primarily is that the purpose of privileged discourse was to help identify hierarchies in society, hierarchies of gender and race and so on and so forth. But it's much in the same way that diversity, say, has become this kind of generic value that doesn't really have much substantive content anymore beyond that, isn't it great that people look different? Privilege has become this, isn't it great that we recognize whatever, you know, social positioning we have. And I think I would have liked to see a sharper point on the idea that, or on the fact, not even the idea, that even if, you know, privilege discourse is flawed, but these hierarchies really do exist. And that they matter not because of our individual relationship to them, but that they matter because they shape society and they shape people's life outcomes, and that we do have an obligation to dismantle them. And if privilege discourse is the problem, is that it obscures that social obligation and places the focus on the individual, in the same way I think that diversity rhetoric obscures that the reason why we even cared about making sure that there is proper representation, and that was as a remedy to historic injustice, was as a remedy to material deprivation.
Let me try to draw a line, and this may or may not work, but between two different notions of possible notions of privilege, and it builds on what I think is the most, to me, interesting or provocative insight in the essay, which is that privilege checking corresponds completely with the massive rise in inequality. So over the last, say, 20 to 30 years, what might that relationship be? On the one hand, when you accuse someone of privilege, or when you try to make someone enlightenedly conscientious about their or someone else's level of privilege. You're saying that people did not come to market, did not bring their talents and abilities to market on equal terms. And in that sense, as a power of kind of social enlightenment, it's absolutely necessary because the market paradigm became, you know, dominant. It sort of squats over all, I mean, it enables some of us while squatting on others of us. But over the last 30 years, it's become utterly dominant. And the pretense of the market is, in theory, the utopian ideal behind the market is that it is utterly blind to color, gender, or class in some way. And it was important to constantly put the lie to that construct of the market as a sort of perfect weighing measurement of our, you know, the utility that we bring to it. The downside is that it plays into a kind of market rhetoric, so far as I can tell, because it then says we can only measure people according to the myth of self-making, in a way, which is itself another, I think, kind of heavily free market imbued mythology, that someone can in some way, or someone only gets full responsibility for what value they create if it can be said they did it without an unfair privilege, i.e. in a perfect field of competition, i.e. the free market, right? So to my mind, you're trying to sort of cut that, slice that carefully in a way where you're making people aware of unfair advantages, life advantages. At the same time, I don't think what you want to do is measure value or utility constantly against a personal mythology of pure self-making.
I don't quite know that I agree with what you said about the rise in inequality and then going along with privilege. I don't know. I think she makes that point in the essay. I'm not sure that that has particularly any that's more than a coincidence. What I would say is that I think that the point that you make about that we need to be aware of people's privilege, that is different from saying that when someone is making an argument or someone is engaging in, you know, they're writing an article or they're talking with friends or so on, that at that moment, their argument or what they're saying or doing needs to be judged based on the privilege they have. And I think that's an important distinction. The idea that, yes, we need to know that the privilege is a reality. People come into the world and become adults and whatever with completely different circumstances, and there are these structures of power that keep people where they are. I'm not sure that that's helpful to constantly talk about when an individual person, whether they be privileged or not privileged, is making an argument, when we're judging that argument or when we're thinking about what they themselves are saying. One thing that I was thinking that this essay made me think about is that I remember in the New Republic, actually, 3 or 4 months ago, the same week, two different articles appeared by different writers. And one of them was essentially saying, you know, these white people who voted for Donald Trump, they're not privileged. They are poor. They've been screwed over by capitalism and neoliberalism, and they are not privileged, et cetera, et cetera. We need to have sympathy for them, even though they've elected this racist maniac. And the other article was a literary piece, and it said, all white people, essentially, I'm not quoting exactly, but all white people have great privilege. And it is interesting to me that you have, coming from people on the left, these two arguments almost simultaneously. And I do think they contradict each other. Both of them seem like together they combine to make kind of an interesting cultural moment about how we think about privilege.
Yeah, I mean, I think those dueling articles get to the heart of the problem with privilege discourse, right? That, like, just the word privilege implies a certain amount of security, right? Like material security, social security, so on and so forth, that a lot of people whom are designated as privilege holders don't actually have. On the other, it is the case that, for example, low-income white Trump voters do have a certain amount of security from the ethno-nationalist policies of a Trump administration. So they're not, their families aren't going to be deported. They won't be stopped. Insofar that they're traveling, leaving the country, they won't be stopped at the border. They won't face the kind of suspicion of non-whites that the Trump administration has brought to national policy. And so not since they are privileged, but like privilege isn't really, it's not really the right word for that, right? Or at least I don't think it's a entirely helpful word. I think what we're trying to identify here, and I'm not sure we have the language for here, at least among, at least in mainstream conversation, and I'd say very specifically among the white left, is this idea of race hierarchy, that these Trump voters, for example, may not have much in the way of material privilege, but they do occupy a spot in a hierarchy. That spot is higher than others within that hierarchy, and that they have material interests tied to their position in that hierarchy. And so one thing you can see very clearly throughout American history is that like white people across class lines often act politically to preserve the salience of their whiteness within society. To note that isn't to say that someone does not deserve sympathy for their material deprivation, but it is to point out that they have particular interests that run counter to other interests that we might also hold. So if you believe in racial egalitarianism, then yeah, there's a bit of a problem when some prospective allies for your economic program are resistant to racial egalitarianism in a meaningful way. That's what I think we're trying to identify here. And I just think that privilege discourse obscures this so much and leads to odd places where, for example, you're arguing that because a group of people are materially deprived, therefore they bear no responsibility for their decision to uphold violent race hierarchies.
That was terrific. All right. Well, here I'll insert the fairly obvious observation that a rarity for this program, it's a panelist of three men. Among the privilege filters you can place on reality, of course, is gender. Clearly the conversation was a different kind of conversation because of that. Is privilege exactly the right word to describe that? You can come tell us at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, moving on. All right, well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse. Jamel, what do you have?
So the first segment we spent talking about Logan and James Mangold, and sort of after I saw Logan, I was so impressed with the film that I decided to go watch Copland, which I had never actually seen before. And Copland is great. I'm not really breaking any news there. But I think it's great. It's useful. It was useful for me to watch after seeing Logan because I can sort of see more of Mangold's sort of directorial interest. And in particular, with Copland, which stars Sylvester Stallone as the sheriff of a town basically built by cops, that houses cops in New York City, I think there's something similar happening there of choosing, you have an actor who very much embodies kind of hyperviolence in a role that is saturated with a kind of wariness. And I thought it was interesting watching that, not as a contrast, but sort of like kind of helping me understand Mangold's choices in Logan. And it's also just, it's a terrific film. I was really impressed by it. I watched it with my wife. My wife, who hates Sylvester Stallone, came out of it like, you know, I can't believe this guy can actually act. I highly recommend checking it out if you haven't already.
Copland's a great movie. It really is. I totally agree. It's a minor triumph, and Stallone is fantastic in it. Isaac, what do you have?
So I know there's a new Kong movie out, which I have not seen yet, and has been getting some good reviews, however. But I did go back and watch the 2005 Peter Jackson version of King Kong, which made a lot of money at the time, but I think was seen as somewhat of a disappointment. And not entirely incorrectly, the first hour of the movie is almost unwatchably boring, and it's way, 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 way too long. But The whole middle section of the movie, which is about 90 minutes, is which I just rewatched on television, is about as good movie entertainment as I think I've ever seen. I think it ranks up there with the truly great Spielberg movies, those types of Spielberg movies, such as the first and third Indiana Jones movie, things like that, Jaws. I think it's it really is Hollywood at its absolute best. Even the fact that the movie is overlong, I really do think it's worth checking out. And it also has a just fantastic performance by Naomi Watts in a role that could have easily gone to someone who was not interested in particularly acting, or the character could have been written in such a way that it didn't need an actress. And she is just fantastic. And I understand why the movie was seen as a disappointment, but there's really some incredible, incredible stuff in there. And I recently reread a very long essay in the London Review of Books that came out last year. It's called Apartheid's Last Stand, and it's by a man named Jeremy Harding, who writes frequently for the London Review of Books. It's about Angola after independence and the civil war that happened there in the last 10 years or so of the Cold War, where the Americans, the South Africans, the Russians, the Cubans were all involved. And the book, the piece is the length of a very short book. It's over 14,000 words, but it's one of the best single things I've ever read about the Cold War and the different things that we were doing and the Russians were doing and the different ethical and non-ethical considerations involved, and the way it takes in different perspectives and the way it shines a light on some of the alliances of that period is simply stunning. And I don't know much about Angola, and I assume many people do not either. And it's an absolutely stunning piece of work. Apartheid's Last Stand, it's called.
So this week I'm going to endorse an essay in the Aeon online magazine written by Adam Frank, who's an astronomy professor at Rochester and is a contributor of one kind or another to NPR. It's a terrific essay about the problem of consciousness relative to physics and what we know about physics, and whether or not the fact that humans are conscious can be thought of as a purely scientific problem using the current paradigm of physics. And he makes a brilliant point that I'd never heard anyone make exactly, which is that we still tend to think a little bit almost with a kind of folklore attitude towards the physical world as inherited from Newton, which is just a bunch of billiard balls or physical objects kind of bouncing off of one another in a law obedient way. And how can we ever insert what we as, you know, mentally endowed creatures do into that scheme? And you can't really. And so this generates over and over again this sort of sterile problem of philosophy, which is what is consciousness and how does it relate to the physical universe? And he makes, in some ways, the quite simple point was that when quantum physics emerged in the late 19th century and early 20th century, you really lost that Newtonian worldview almost completely. I mean, you have to be applying a very crude metaphor to the quantum reality to think of it as little billiard balls bouncing off of one another. And in fact, it's obviously much more about, you know, waves and semi non-material forces, but also probability. And he's someone who actually knows the history of physics and exactly what Schrodinger and Heisenberg contributed to it. And he says, he can't answer, and no one can answer, what human consciousness is relative to this quantum layer of reality. But we're going to have to shift our paradigm so seriously in order to assimilate human consciousness to science. But that paradigm shift has started already with quantum physics. And it sounds preposterous, I know, but it actually is a beautifully written essay targeted at the layperson. And in addition to that, I want to endorse the Courtney Barnett song, Depreston, which I cannot stop listening to. It's totally bewitching. Isaac, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And good luck with the new podcast. I'm very psyched to listen to it. Jamel, as always, a total pleasure. Hope you come back on soon.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai. And Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. The Culture Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out an entire roster of shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Isaac Chotiner and Jamel Bowie, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon.
And I see the handrail in the shower, a collection of those canisters for coffee, tea, and flour.